And probably most of you know Judge John Meyenhofer. And I'm Mary Hoffman from Family Court Services, if you haven't met me. And it's all yours.
Well, it's a pleasure talking with you today. Going to focus especially on very young children, infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. And I'll tell you why this is a thorny issue, because it was brought home to me in a practical way years ago when my wife and I, Nancy, had our very first baby. At that point in time, back in the dark ages, it was the beginning of when they would let a father come into the delivery room. And so I was there in the delivery room. I actually, at the time, was a pre-med student. And here comes the baby. And I am just thrilled, and I announced to the room, "It's a boy." One more push later, it was clearly a girl. I was reacting to the umbilicus. And so, just as a point of fact, that sometimes can be the knotty problem in dealing with very young children. You think you see something, you have a conclusion, only to find out just a little bit later that what you thought was so wasn't really so. So today I'm going to run through very quickly some topics, and the judge, John, is going to jump in wherever he would like to. We're going to have 15 minutes or so at the end for questions, and I hope you take advantage of both of us, because as a psychologist, a forensic psychologist, I always want to hear, what does the court want, what does the court not want, what's relevant, what's not relevant. And it's rare to be able to have much face time to talk to a typical judge, because they don't want to be put into a position of being biased by becoming buddies with somebody who does the kind of work that I do. Okay, let's see if we can make this work. Apparently not. You would vouch that it was working great earlier, right?
I know. Even had IT come over.
Okay, we got that much. So we're talking about very young children and family law. Very young children, infants, 0 to 1, toddlers, 1 to 2, and preschoolers, 3 to 5. And we're going to run through these issues very quickly. First, bonding and attachment versus reciprocal connectedness. And the reason to look at bonding and attachment is you'll hear continuously with very young children, no, they shouldn't do X, Y, Z because it's going to disrupt or damage the bond they have, typically with mom. So this is a relevant issue. Secondly, current research on infants and toddlers, including overnights. And by the way, you don't need to take elaborate notes. If you have your email over here, I'll send you the PowerPoint presentation. I will send you copies of the articles, and no salesman will call. Third, we're going to look at managing common problems, including, and these are issues that I hear as a forensic psychologist. There's a problem in any kind of allocation of parental time because my child is breastfeeding, or because we are in a nesting situation, and we need to figure that out because we're ready to kill each other. He took my diapers. Or looking at exchanges. How do exchanges work with very young children? Special needs kids at this age are extremely challenging if it's identified young, and in terms of parenting skills, and also abuse allegations. My favorite kind of a case is the case that starts off with no record whatsoever of any maltreatment, but mom or dad has physically abused a child. And so it should be supervised visitation one day a month for maybe 1 hour by a highly trained professional. And if we get past that, then maybe it could be every other month for 2 hours. You get the drift. Next issue, factors for crafting parenting plans for very young children. There are some materials that can be helpful. And finally, when to request a parenting time evaluation. I'm sticking that in at the end, and because look at some key components that you'd want to have involved in a parenting time evaluation for very young children. Now we're going backwards. This is going to be fun. There we go. I want to give you a brief history of custody. Some of you may know this, but I found this to be extremely interesting. During the colonial era, fathers always had custody of the children. If there was a death, if there was somehow a separation or divorce, it always went to the father, because the children were treated as chattel. They were property. And they also were treated as an asset in terms of maintaining the family stability in the family home. If you think back to then, how many mommies worked. And so the child always reverted to dad. In the 1790s to the 1890s, there was a developing trend in the law that mothers would get custody, and that would be the foundation here for that mother to be the nurturing parent. She bore the child, she raised the child. Dads typically weren't doing much of that at that point, at very young ages. And so there was then a shift away from the child as property. In the 1900s to 1970, we had a tender years doctrine begin. The tender years doctrine means that, of course, young children had to have the majority of time with a mother, because the mother, again, is best equipped to care for the child. And the tender years doctrine, by the way, around the country still is very prominent in many jurisdictions. It's not even something to discuss. If you have a young child, it's going to be with mom. That's the way it is. Now, when I'm talking about this, it may sound like I'm a father's rights advocate. I'm not. But I am an advocate for common sense, and I am an advocate for the child's best interest, which you'll hear some about as we get into this. In the 1970s, there was the beginning of father's rights movements, and that led to some pronounced shifts in many jurisdictions to a presumption of 50-50 allocation of time, but not necessarily with very young children. And so we have in the 1990s a change where the courts are going like, what in the world are we supposed to do? We have this group over here arguing for one point. We have this group arguing for another point. What we used to think was so isn't so now. And that was when behavioral scientists became involved. Psychologists, depending on the state, counselors, social workers. I remember back when, the early days of my practice, having a call. Would you consider doing a custody evaluation? Well, what would that entail? Nobody knew. This is like in 1980. Nobody knew what that entailed. Well, you could talk to the parents and, you know, look at the kids and tell us what you think. If I tried to pull that off today, I would have a very, very bad time in court. It would not go well for me. But that's how it began, and that's how we began to get behavioral scientists involved in this. Well, behavioral scientists being what they are, all of a sudden think they know more than everybody else. And that becomes a brand new problem. Now we have people that have training, but what they think they know may not be true either. So we still have a conundrum. Is it tender years? Is it kids as dad's property? Is it something we can really get good counsel on? So now we have in the 2000s a development of research that's trying to find some counterbalance to both common sense as well as history, legally, as well as the political scene. And we have emerging research on infant, toddler, especially emphasizing overnights. That's been the hot button. You don't let toddlers and infants spend overnights with their father. Again, depending on the jurisdiction, that can still be cast in concrete. In other places, it is changing. So a little history that you may or may not know. Talking about bonded or connectedness, the research on attachment of children, and you'll, by the way, never find two people to agree what the difference is between bonding and attachment. They're virtually used interchangeably. And when somebody asks me, or I hear somebody asking someone, could you please tell me, is this child bonded or attached? I'm thinking, here we go. This is going to be interesting because we're going to go nowhere and accomplish nothing. But the bottom line is that the bonding and attachment studies were studies that looked at children that had been extremely deprived of social contact, for example, orphanages in Romania. They also were studies of monkeys with people that had been separated from their parents. And so if we had a wire figurine with a towel, and we had one that does not, and we had one that has food, we would see that there would be some selection about contact comfort. And we extrapolated all that to babies. So the tendency has been to argue the point that infants tend to bond or attach to one person significantly in the very early weeks and years of their life. Where that came from, I'm not really sure, because if any of you have very young children, most of the time you'll observe that this isn't simply the case. They bond to a lot of different people depending on who's involved in their life. And so we have that concept now into the court system for years, which argues again for the tender years doctrine, or for one parent having a vast majority of time and no overnights with anyone else, because you don't want to disrupt that bond or that connection. If you disrupt that, that child will be scarred for life, and you will have made a terrible decision. Well, along came a guy named Arredondo and Edwards, two men, and writing from a legal perspective, wrote about how we need to consider reciprocal connectedness. And this is an article that I'll send to you if I have your email. Reciprocal connectedness means we're not looking at a one-way bond or attachment of a person, a baby, or an infant toddler with an adult. We're looking at the interaction. We're looking at the connectedness. I fly a lot from one place or another to do evaluations. And if there's a baby next to me or in the aisle across, I'm a real sucker for babies. When I met my wife, she was actually doing her graduate dissertation on infants and swaddling. And so a long time ago, I learned how to really be cheesy with babies. Hi. How are you? Come on. You know, for most of these babies, within 2 or 3 minutes, they're smiling back at you. We're friends. You know, I don't know if they're going to come and sit in my lap if we have turbulence, but you look at that interaction and that connectedness, and you'll see real quickly that the idea that there's only one stable caregiver and you have to protect that relationship simply doesn't line up with most of what we see in real life. Now, you do have some children, some infants, that are non-cuddlers. You may have seen that, and you'll have parents sometimes that are very non-cuddly. They're not very warm. And for those particular cases, I'm not even sure it matters that we talk about attachment or bonding, because they're not really attached or bonded to anybody. They're just kind of there, and they go with the flow. But the idea that one stable caregiver is critical, I don't think is a wise idea in general. Secondly, there's a principle that there can always be more than one stable caregiver. Back in the day when my children were young, I would take them out and go somewhere, and somebody would say, "Oh, you're babysitting, that's wonderful." And I would look at them with a mildly insulted look, and I would go, "I am fathering." There's a difference, right? And you have a lot of people as men that want to take that and own the role of being a father. Then you have some men that would like the title, but they don't know what to do. And then you have some guys that want to see the kid when they're 12. So you have different levels at all times. Principle is that a child bonds or attaches to a caregiver, but he reciprocally connects with a caregiver. That's something to really be aware of in the cases that you have, either from a social scientist standpoint or from a legal standpoint. Because at the end of the day, if you're an attorney, you may have to advocate for your client in court. You may have to represent them well. But by the same token, you also have an obligation in many ways to teach your clients what is in the best interest of the child. And that may not be exactly what a mom or dad thinks is in their best interest. So the conclusion, we want to promote that young children have connectedness with both parents, presuming that there aren't negative factors that would oppose that kind of a viewpoint. So a little bit of research on very young children. The big controversy has been brewing for a long time, but it came to a head, especially in 2010, when Australia, as a government, funded some major studies on the impact of allocation of time for very, very young children. Jennifer McIntosh is the lead researcher for this group. She's very well respected. Her research is respected. And her conclusions made international news. Infants that were placed in overnight situations weekly as part of a custody plan, she thought and found, were more irritable, that they were more seeking or missing the primary parent, which would be whom? The mom, in most cases. And they had more wheezing. Now, when you hear more wheezing, it sounds like, so give them some singular. But the wheezing would be an indication of stress or anxiety for an infant. And so when her results came out with this, she also looked at toddlers. She said toddlers, if they spend overnights, were less persistent in carrying out tasks. They gave up more quickly. They shifted to other activities. They had more crying. They had more clinging. And they had more behavior problems. Now, I'm vastly oversimplifying what she found. It's a highly detailed set of research. But she did come up with, by the time they were preschoolers, 4 and 5, that those distinctions disappeared, that those kids did not have any noticeable differences between those staying overnights and those not staying overnights. At 4 and 5, it seemed okay. So in Australia, it became virtually a court presumption that if you had a child that was 2 years or younger, no overnights, period. Mom would be the primary caretaker. End of discussion. Move to a different country if you don't like that conclusion. Well, that led to some controversy here in this country because people had been doing research on very young children for also a number of years. Rick Warshak is a psychologist in Dallas. Dallas is one of the places that I practice, and Rick is highly regarded for a lot of his research on any aspect of divorce, reunification, young children, you can name it. He's probably researched and done some work on it. Warshak came up with an opposing view that regular and frequent involvement by very young children, VYC, I just abbreviated for space, that frequent and regular involvement of very young children with both parents is critical to their development and critical to their well-being. So now you see the creative tension. One country is saying no. Another well-respected researcher is saying you're wrong. It needs to be quite different, opposite than what you concluded. In 2014, he released a paper that he called a consensus report that was signed by over 100 behavioral scientists and researchers around the world, saying that he was right. They agreed with his conclusions that not having overnights or not having extended amounts of time with the non-maternal parent, the father, was appropriate and was necessary. So now we have the ante even upped higher. He suggests that overnights are a protective factor for father's commitment to the child and for a father's commitment financially to the child. You may have noticed over the years that fathers, as they got more time, courts realized that they were actually paying child support now in those particular cases. And so we have here Warshak saying that overnights are a protective factor. It's not a negative factor, it's actually a positive. And that sufficient evidence does not exist, this is from his article, does not exist to support postponing regular and frequent involvement, including overnights, of both parents with babies and toddlers. I was in a case in Dallas, a really high dollar custody case. Both parents were millionaires. And Warshak testified on this as an expert witness. The thing that he testified is obviously what he said right here. The other thing that I'll testify to was that he only rarely testifies in court as an expert witness, and his fee was $45,000. So sometimes we all should have studied a little longer and seen where it would have taken us. There's another guy out of Arizona, University of Arizona, Bill Fabricius. Fabricius is an interesting researcher in that he's well-respected, but he doesn't have the national pop platform that Warshak has. And Fabricius said that the father's role with very young children is not only warranted, but is very critical for their future social, emotional, and academic development. He suggests that with very young children, including infants, you can do up to 50-50 time with very young children with no harm, that the long-term benefits are there for both mom and dad, that the parents' agreement or their level of conflict is irrelevant, and that what he found by using a research protocol that's practical, he talked to college students whose parents have been divorced and asked them about their experiences growing up in situations where it was hostile between the parents, where it was not hostile, all the various combinations. And what he found was it didn't matter really what the mother's role was. What made a difference predicting better academic, emotional condition, and social success was the father's involvement. So if the parents didn't get along, or they did get along, didn't seem to be a factor in how the kid turned out. What did seem to turn out as a factor, though, was that the kid, if he was involved with both parents from a very young age, had high regard for both parents, unless one of them had totally blown it somehow with their specific behavior with them later in life. So we have here an interesting study that's really arguing it's not just a protective factor, but it may be a critical factor for beneficial results as that child grows up. The early analysis that he did begins with kids at the age of 9. So we have young children who are showing a beneficial effect at a young age compared to not having contact time at a young age with a father. Nielsen is an author that just wrote about the quality of the parent relationship, stating that it's better as a predictor than conflict of children's outcomes. So let me explain that. Remember, we talked about how connectedness reciprocal connectedness is really more important than getting hung up on bonding to one parent or the other. So Nielsen is really coming along and saying, look, the relationship, the connectedness, carries more weight than the parent conflict. If you have a high conflict parent case, so when I come into a parenting time evaluation as a forensic evaluator, it's obviously high conflict. We're dealing with, what, 2.5%, 3% of the cases that would ever go to that level. If I come into that case, the tendency can be for an evaluator to focus on how mom and dad don't like each other. It's a long-standing battle. He's a jerk. You know, she's a slut. Nobody is getting along, and we just need to somehow find a way to help this kid. Well, what they're finding is the way you help the kid is to have the kid have a constructive relationship with both parents. That's the key variable. So the level of conflict is not predictive of this kid doing well. It's predictive to look at their relationship with both parents, which then argues more and more strongly for things like co-parenting classes when you know they're never going to co-parent, they're going to parallel parent. But if they really could have good instructions and good ideas of what do you do to get past the drama, just let it roll off your back, be nice, and focus on your kid, that would be a huge positive step. She also said that with these kids and the research, she said a lot of people are being woozled. When you read her article, you'll enjoy that she's saying researchers are cherry-picking what they think is really probative for their position, and they are bamboozling or woozling the general public with this information, which leads me to say to you that all of the researchers that I've ever talked to, Rick Warshak, Bill Fabricius, and others, if you ask them about a particular case, you know, I'm involved in this case with this very young child, you know, what's your opinion? They will cut you off at the knees and they'll say, I do research. I do not do application. So they will tell you very quickly, they do not intend to offer any of us guidance per se on your case. They are giving you research for a particular situation. If I were to take you back and look at McIntosh's research in Australia or Warshak's research, and we looked at the instruments that measure that child's improvement or that child's decline, you would look at it and you go like, really? You're kidding. I mean, this is what we're gauging all of our findings on. It's just not very robust or very encouraging to see what we have to use with very young children. It's nothing that you would want to send your kid off to school or not to school over. So the researchers will say, we're just doing research. Don't apply it as a standard to a particular person. Well, what will you hear? Research says. I was going to read to you some excerpts of a couple of PTEs from Idaho, but I'll just do a little bit from memory. One said that, well, a two-year-old does not have the memory and cognitive mapping to be able to know really where they've been in the even middle past. And therefore, mom, who has the kid, and by the way, fled with the kid without agreement by anybody, mom who has the kid should retain custody of the kid. Because if we were to send it back to dad's, even on a regular visitation basis, the kid would be confused. He doesn't have the memory to know where he would be. And I'm thinking, okay, let me see. I've got 5 grandkids. Two of them live in Washington, D.C. They come out once a year. One of them is now 3. When he was 2 and came out, he immediately went to the bookshelf. He didn't need a mapping or instructions. He immediately went to the bookshelf. He went to the closet door where we had stuffed all his toys. I mean, come on. All right, practical implications for research. Number one, every case is unique. Research offers guidance. Your case isn't research. Secondly, to look at having extended time with a parent to me means you need to have a willing parent. If you have a parent that's willing, they may not have the skills. I learned as a young father, because I had no sisters and I had a younger brother, when I changed the diapers of my 2 daughters, you go from front to back. Now, I would never have known that if somebody hadn't told me. And they would have UTIs to this day, courtesy of me. But if you have a willing parent, you have a start. Second, third, competent parenting skills or willingness to learn. You have to have the ability to be teachable if you're going to look at doing some of these things on a practical basis. Many of you will have noticed in some of your cases, the guy comes in as a jerk, but he actually steps up his game And he now is spending more time with the kids than he ever did face-to-face, and he actually improves as a parent. Some guys remain a jerk. So, fourth, sufficient contact time between the child and the parent. In one of the cases in Northwest Idaho, the court ordered that the father could have visitation with a two-year-old for up to 8 hours once a month. Up to 8 hours once a month. And then the evaluator said, "Dad does not have good parenting skills." And I'm thinking, right, because he hasn't been able to parent anything. We have number five, you need a resilient child. Some children are clingy to a primary parent, or they're clingy to one parent or the other. If you have that, you need to deal with what you're dealing with. You need to deal with the child. This is all about the best interests of the child. And if you have a very anxious, a very dependent child for whatever reason, there's no reason that we can say to this family, well, he needs to spend half his time with dad and just rip this kid apart. You need to find a plan where you might see if you can increase time and have the kid be stable. But there's no hard and fast rules. And lastly, this is never about dad's or mom's rights. It's all about the kid and charting a path for his or her best development. I'll look at reports, and what I will see is page after page after page of how the parents really didn't like each other. And literally see one page about the kid. And I'm thinking that the report really should be page after page about the kid, and then what are the parent competences? All right, managing common parental concerns. We will have time to talk about this, by the way. I'm just trying to get through it. First of all, breastfeeding. I've heard repeatedly, "I'm breastfeeding my child. They cannot go for overnights. They cannot go for an extended time. I breastfeed at 12, I breastfeed at 3. So you can have from 12:30 to 2:30. And I'm thinking, and you also have tickets to go see the concert tonight and a babysitter arranged. You've pumped and you have 3 gallons of milk in the fridge. It can often just become a simple ruse, quite frankly. And so when this comes up, it's something to anticipate and I think be instructive of a parent. No, you're going to have to find a different way to go about it. Now, as a mom, I wouldn't be thrilled about pumping and pumping. When I was, again, with my first daughter, one night in bed, our daughter was in between Nancy and I, and for reasons totally unknown to me, she rolled over to me and rooted on me. I thought breastfeeding was like this. Oh my God, it was like being hooked up to a vacuum pump. I thought I was going to crawl out of my skin. So I'm sure it's going to be difficult to tell a mom, go ahead and just have your soul sucked dry here so your daddy can take the kid overnight. But on the other hand, if you're looking at the positive impact of doing that kind of thing, it's important. A stable environment. I've heard a lot of people say, well, he's not stable. And he may not be. And if he's not, then that should really be the key factor. But a lot of times I hear he's not stable, but the kid's in daycare for 12 hours. He's not stable, but it's the grandparents' house, you know, every weekend, all day on Saturday. So it's really important to look at the context of what is the environment this kid is in and what really is realistic in trying to promote the best interests of the kid. Been in a number of situations where the court has ordered nesting. I can see nesting when you have a month or so for parents to get their affairs in order, get an apartment, get another home, and move out. But in one particular case, the parents had nested for 9 months. And I think that was actually doing more damage to the situation than not. Because literally, they were fighting over, you took my diapers, where's my formula? You got into my drawer with my underthings. It just promoted more hostility and conflict between the adults. And if nothing else is true today, one thing that is true regardless of the research, the biggest factor in children not doing well at any age is overt parent conflict. So if you have parents that are fighting, or you have even covert sometimes, you know, total silence and dirty looks, kids pick up on that. And they pick up on that as babies. You know, if you're a mom, you probably remember that your kid, if you were anxious, your kid fussed. If you weren't anxious and you were happy, they were thrilled. Well, I'm a daddy. I didn't see that right off the bat. But as I would talk to women and I would see how they're doing emotionally, it was really clear. You could have a 6-month-old, and if the mom is a basket case, this kid is really struggling. Prolonged exchanges. If you're going to exchange young children, it does not help to drag this out. In my opinion, it needs to be quick, it needs to be simple, and it needs to be structured. These 10-minute, 15-minute goodbyes, let me kiss you in the van before you go, you know, all it's doing is promoting a weird sense of dependence, and all it's doing is promoting, you're going to be in trouble if you leave me. And kids want to do what? They want to please a parent. Now they're torn. They got one parent that wants to drive off and go have fun. They have the other parents falling apart. Who do they pick? Reliance on screens for babysitting. I have sat and observed kids many times where mom or dad is making breakfast and the kid is sitting at the table glued to an iPad watching something. Now some of that's practical, I get it, you know, it can be educational or whatever, but I mean literally day after day after day, that is the new de facto babysitter. And by the way, as a side point about why that's not a wise idea, a research in Great Britain indicated a few years ago that the average age for exposure to pornography in Great Britain is 6. 6 years old on a screen. Parental nudity. I've had people object because mom or dad parades around their under things, or they're nude, or they're wanting to bathe or take a shower with the kid. Bottom line is, depending on your culture and depending on the kid and depending on the parent and how their family is structured, could be a big deal or could be a non-deal. It could be a non-entity. I still remember a case where mom was very upset because their 3-year-old was still taking showers with dad. And I'm thinking, like, I don't find that to be that unusual. You know, unless dad's doing something weird with a kid. Now, if the kid was 9, I don't know. I'm not sure why they would want to do it. If it was a 9-year-old daughter, I would call that maltreatment. Right? And then we have allegations of abuse, sexual or physical. And again, I'm just bringing this up because I know that in some cases, certainly not in Idaho, but I can tell you in Texas, where family law is a blood sport, that there are some attorneys that have programmed into their word processor ex parte motions that start off with allegations of sexual or physical abuse where nothing's ever been on the record for anything. So I'm just saying that to me is a red flag about really whose interests are really being promoted. It's got to be the kid. Crafting parenting plans for very young children. I think I'm going to get this within the time, John. I'm surprised.
Sounds good to me.
All right. And crafting plans, to me, it's very, very critical. If you're an attorney, you're probably also trained in mediation. If you're here as a social scientist, you may also be trained somewhat in mediation. I think it's very important to focus on the key differences that are preventing settlement. A lot of times people, once they're in the court system, they really don't think they're being listened to. When I do a parenting time evaluation, I listen to both people, and I listen to them extensively. And one of the reasons that the cases typically will settle is because they finally found somebody that would listen to them, and they have some sense of being respected. So if you can look at the key differences preventing settlement, that to me would be huge before you ever get to crafting a parenting plan. I had one situation where the key difference was whether or not you could take the kid out of state for a vacation. And the problem was that the person's relatives were infirm and couldn't travel. And the opposing parent was just outraged at the thought that you're going to kidnap the kid, take him 2 states over, and so forth and so on. You have to look at the sticking points. Secondly, use resources to guide your thinking for very young children. If you haven't already looked at the state of Arizona, they have an outstanding Planning for Parenting Time brochure, and they've done this for well over a decade. It's an Arizona guide for parents living apart. It is impacted by current research. People like Bill Fabricius had input into their parenting plans for very young children. And it will give you, for example, an age range. Let's just say for argument it's 0 to 2. And they'll say, here's plan 1. Here's an example of plan 2. Here's an example. They'll go through 6 different plans to kind of prompt your thoughts. Well, that also gives you a concrete document to put into a parent's hands and say, look, this is what is often done in one state that is highly organized to attend to the needs of very young children. Take a look at that and tell me what you think. Because at the end of the day, even when this case is settled, you know it's not settled if the parents haven't figured out how to get along. And to that end, if we can have parent A going, this is my proposal, and parent B going, well, this is my proposal, and you force out the middle, then maybe they'll have a fighting chance to actually have an environment that's decent for the kid as they get older. So that's one plan that you can look at from Arizona. And then there is a woman named Leslie Droz from California that has written a number of books on parenting plans, but one particularly that you might find friendly is a custody tree, decision tree resource. And that's called Parenting Plan and Child Custody Evaluations. You can pick that up on Amazon. If you go to her website under Leslie Droz, you'll also find that she has a number of articles that she will give away for you to download for free. When to request a parenting time evaluation? Well, obviously when it's high conflict and one party is immovable. I had a case recently where the guy said, because he was a charter pilot for one of the regional fractional jet companies, well, my work week is always from Sunday to Saturday morning. I cannot change it. So I need 50-50 from that period of time to this period of time. Well, he had some other problems that didn't argue for 50-50, and when I wrote my report and indicated what I thought was appropriate, he said, well, I told you I could have changed my schedule if that was a factor. No, you didn't, and I recorded everything we talked about. And so you got to have people understand that what they think is immovable may actually not be their friend. If you have little client control, it may really call for a parenting time evaluation. I have talked after cases with attorneys that I know who were just thrilled to have their client that they had no client control over be involved in a parenting time evaluation because finally they could get somebody else to shout at and yell at instead of them, and they could get this thing settled. Somebody with active life-controlling problems argues, I think, for a parenting time evaluation. Somebody who's in the middle of criminal legal charges, somebody who has a drug problem that's not well controlled. A recent case, the dad had a meth problem, and he was being hair tested, and he noted that he had been sober for a long time, and really, a couple months ago, he just fell off twice because of the pressure of the divorce case. And it's like, okay, I think that calls for more. Unresolved allegations of maltreatment, alternative dispute resolution failure, you've tried everything you've got, nothing's working, and the evaluator can provide a report in 90 days or less. I say that because in Dallas, the typical turnaround time for a custody evaluation, which is what it's called in Texas, is somewhere between 9 to 18 months. That's being accepted as customary. I have a blog on my website which says if you can have a baby during the time the report is being generated, there is something amiss in all of this. People are sick of their situation if they get to this level. They want to have it done. And it needs to be done well, but it needs to be done timely so this whole thing can be put to rest and move on. And then best practices, things to look at for PTEs for very young children. The PTE is not a report on the parents. It is a report on the comparative parenting skills of mom and dad, the needs of the child, and the resulting fit. And that literally is a definition from the American Psychological Association. I need to look at the parenting skills. If dad's looking at pornography, the kid never sees it, never saw it, mom agrees, not my problem. I need to look at the kid's needs. If the mom is just anxious and hyper-controlling, but the kid loves spending time with her, good. That's one of his needs. We've got to deal with both. And then we need to look at the resulting fit. In my reports, I do a comparison. And most of the time, it's like, not a problem, not a problem, not a problem, not a problem. The number of areas where there's a specific favoritism or problem towards one parent or the other is usually pretty limited. You don't usually get cases where somebody is just like, you know, a narcissistic, sociopathic, deviant. And that could be a quote probably from one of your clients. right? Not very often do you truly get that. In looking at a PTE, the functional behavior trumps any label you want to come up with. So if somebody says, well, mom's bipolar, I don't care if she's bipolar, I want to know if she's acting like bipolar non-treated. If somebody says, this person's off the hook, they were out half naked in the front yard, 2 o'clock in the morning, screaming for people to come out and play with a sprinkler, they may never have been diagnosed as bipolar, but I think I have a hot clue. You know, something's going on. I'm looking then for the functional behavior throughout this entire report. Functional behavior on parenting skills. Functional behavior of the child. It's not about diagnosis. It is not about labels. In fact, in a parenting time evaluation, I'll suggest to you there's no room ever for a diagnosis unless you're reporting a pre-existing diagnosis that's already in the record, in which case you're going to look at the functional behavior concerning that diagnosis, because diagnoses can be wrong. Looking at objective measures for very young children, it's very difficult to find anything meaningful that we could say, we tested this kid. You know, we did something that was credible within the field that's structured. But there is an observational tool called the HOME, written by a woman named Betty Caldwell out of the University of Arkansas. It's an observational tool. It's not incredibly robust, but it does really hit the high points, and it's used not only for sometimes custody work if people know about it. A lot of people don't know about it. It's used also in child protection agencies. So the HOME is a measure. And then in the PTE, you want to look for a lot of observation. In one particular case, there were two infant twins. Well, that sounds redundant, doesn't it? That would be four kids. There was actually one set of twins and a three-year-old. And I would go there at bedtime to watch Dad put the kids to bed. I would go there at bedtime to watch Mom put the kids to bed. It was dark. They had on lullaby music. I thought I was going to face plant on the floor half the time just trying to observe all of this. I would go there in the morning to see breakfast, and lo and behold, the three-year-old's on an iPad all the time. I would either ride with a parent. I ended up riding with them because you couldn't really follow them well. Riding with a parent when they were doing an exchange to see how it went. You have to have a lot of observational time compared to a 12-year-old. If I go to somebody's home and there's a 12 and a 14-year-old, unless it's really not a good situation, everybody's happy, they're playing, they're doing their homework, there's really nothing to write home about. So that's pretty easy and pretty brief. Here where you have people that can't talk for themselves, you have to see what those skills are. And then finally, the allocation of parenting time rule for young children. There is no hard and fast rule. This is a lawyer's answer I love. It depends. It depends on the circumstances, and you've got to take the fact pattern, the observations, and line it up with the skills, the fit, to see what the recommendations would be. And the recommendations can be guided by some of the research that I pointed out, but you have to have common sense rule. There's some useful connections I put up here. If you're not a member of the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts, you should be, as an attorney especially. AFCC has regional meetings, it has national meetings. Attorneys are welcomed and highly involved, as are some judges. And the role of AFCC is to promote good parenting practices, deal with thorny problems that people play out in their families, as well as to give you access to the Family Court Review, which is an outstanding journal that has consistent articles on family law cases. It is just a huge asset. There's also an organization called Zero to Three. So if you're looking at practical information that a parent could use or you could use, Zero to Three is an organization that offers practical information and policy information. They also have an annual convention as well as regional meetings, and you can get the audio from some of those workshops if that ever interests you to look at. If you're not around babies recently, you may not know which level of diapers to buy or that it would be good to know. You might not know what type of baby food category you should buy at what age. But you should probably know that if you're going to be an evaluator making recommendations, right? If Dad's going like, I basically buy Cheerios. You know, I see moms using Cheerios. That's good. We have some parenting skills. Planning for parenting time, that is the Arizona manual. It's free online. That's the web address. And then one of the fellows that you might find interesting, because it's a great bucket of all kinds of information, is Ken Pope. He has a website that really is a collection of all the ethics rules, all the guidelines on this, all the guidelines on that. It's not just exclusive at all to family law issues. It's on everything. So if you have a mental health case or you have a concern about anything in the psychology realm, he has a huge collection of information. All right. We made it. So, Your Honor.
That was outstanding. I'm here and I'm looking around the room, and I practice with Ken and Tori and Ann, and frankly, this was very informative for me. I probably should be sitting in the audience as opposed to sitting here. You know, from the standpoint of, you know, being a judge now 3 to 4 years, it'll be 4 years in July. I have one luxury up in Adams County that I take advantage and avail myself of, and that is that I actually take evidence at temporary hearings. I don't necessarily require only affidavits because I think there's a lot of sanitation that happens, and I want to see people, and I want to look and see how they're behaving in court. Often that's very instructive to me. I don't have a whole lot of divorces, but when I do, Adams County being Adams County, there's not a lot of resource up there, and so I have to make a lot of decisions on my own. That's not always the easiest thing to do. Family Court Services, the Court Assistance Office is extremely helpful for me. Even all the way up there, we have court assistants coming up and helping us. Specifically when it comes to young children, I can tell you that from my own perspective, I really look very carefully at the character of the parents. I look and see, you know, what is mom doing? What is dad doing? You know, I see if, you know, do they have a criminal record? If so, what is it? Do they look like they're major drug addicts? I mean, sometimes it's obvious, other times it isn't. You know, what kind of allegations are the two people making against each other? You know, so those are the types of things that I look at. You know, down here, I don't do divorces generally, although every once in a while I'll get one conflicted to me, and then I sit and I take evidence. Here, you know, I generally am going to have temporary orders only on the affidavits, like the... you know, like what is typical in Ada County and in Canyon County. So for anybody that's a practitioner, if you have a case in Adams County, the family law rules, the new rules are very specific that the court can take evidence, and I like to do that if the circumstances are appropriate. So I will also say, just to follow up on Dr. Davidson, I'm a member of the AFCC. I became a member last year. I went to the conference in Seattle last year. I can tell you I was extremely impressed with the presentation of information, the quality of the people that are involved. I continue to be a member. I'm not going to go to the conference this year, but I'm going to try to go next year again. And so I think it's important to just continue to educate yourself on a lot of these issues. I don't have a lot to add here. I mean, frankly, as I said, I was very happy to meet Dr. Davidson. I'm very happy to get this information, and I want to leave enough time, so 10 minutes now for questions and answers. But I also thought I'd just kind of briefly share the way that I do things up in council, and if you potentially have a case with me in Canyon County, here in Canyon County. So with that, I don't have anything further to add.
Let me add one thing as far as AFCC. I think it's every other year, AAML will also, together with AFCC, have a child custody conference, and they have one coming up in September in San Diego. It is, again, not a mental health specialist oriented conference. It is truly a mixture of legal as well as behavioral health. And San Diego's a whole lot closer than Boston.
Yeah, I just got the advertisement for that the other day. Yeah. And I've got that earmarked as potentially going to go to that in September. So.
I find them both excellent. I was at one in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and the flavor of it was different than just AFCC. It was really nice to see a really strong legal component to it. So with that in mind, questions for His Honor concerning his thinking about cases with overnights, young kids, whatever, both of us, myself. What does anybody...
Actually, let me just add that I don't
you know, in terms of children, really young toddlers, I do not have a hard and fast rule. I am flexible on that. Again, to me, it's every case is different, and it depends. Mm-hmm. If you've got parents that are getting along, they come up with a plan, and they're good with having a child switch back and forth. I'm not gonna do anything different because they're getting along, and that's fine with me. In other circumstances, I've got one parent that's potentially an 8 or a 9 on the humanity scale, and the other one's a 1 or a 2. You know, the 1 or 2's not likely going to get overnights, you know. So, I mean, everything's different, but I am flexible. So I just wanted to add that.
And that's huge. Any other questions or comments?
Have you presented to the other judges, I mean, we're practitioners, earning this degree here, but, you know, sometimes we kind of look at some, having worked in front of these judges all the time, and some are pretty pigeonholed. So I just would like to know if you've had a chance to meet with the judges here.
And I appreciate that. I have a... We'll see what happens, but I have an interest in trying to be available to the court if it's helpful to judges. Judges are judges, and they've earned their stripes. So I have no presumption that I have anything to offer that is remarkable, but I have a desire to be useful in that way if it ever is appropriate. And we'll probably look at doing some continuing legal education with the Idaho Bar, things of that nature. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? Yes.
I want to thank Mary if she's the one who put this together. This was awesome. Thanks for doing that, Mary. And I'm Cassie with Child Advocacy Services. I do supervise visitation. I've done it for 12 years. I've only been in Nampa for about 4 years. But my question for you, Judge, is in Wyoming, we were a very small community, a small state. I knew the judges. I knew what their expectations were. I also ran the CASA program, so I played the hats. You know, I wore both hats. But when I write my reports for supervised visitation, I write, obviously, how it went. But oftentimes, I also put notes in there of how it went with trying to schedule appointments with the parents. I do that so that the judges will see if it's really, they're making it difficult, which parent is really making it difficult to try to schedule. Is that helpful for the judges?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In a word.
Is there anything else that would be helpful that you could relay? Again, I will be at the supervised visitation at work. It's at the same time that the conference for AFCC is on. But is there anything else that you could tell us that you really find helpful in report writing?
Well, I read, I think when it might have been one of your reports in the last 30 days or so as I was reviewing a case file, and you were very specific about talking about, and I don't want to give anything away because the case is still going on, but you talked about how the parent that had the supervised visits was coming in and being somewhat manipulative and had to constantly be monitored to not get into inappropriate conversations with the kids. And I was very impressed with that report. And again, I think it was one of yours. And yeah, that's something I want to know. If you've got a parent that is having supervised visits, and who knows what the reason is for that, and they get into those visits, and they start behaving badly and not following the rules, I mean, am I inclined to make those visits unsupervised? I don't think so. So how are they behaving in the context of the visit itself? And then, all of those issues. Call them on the phone. They don't answer. You know, the visit's scheduled for 4 for 1 hour, and they show up at 4:30. I mean, all of that to me is relevant and has to be looked at in the big picture. So, I've read your reports and I like them. Thank you.
In the context of the mediation status reports, there's been some back and forth on whether or not the mediator should include whether or not there's a suspicion of domestic violence happening. Is that something, as a judge, you would like to see on the status reports?
In a word, yes. I mean, that's something else. Well, domestic violence takes so many different forms, and
I would like to comment on that, though, Darcy. I think that the concern with the mediation community and people that have been mediating for a long time is liability. Because what if you have a case where maybe you missed the domestic violence and something happens? So there was a reason that, because that used to be a checkbox on the status reports, and there's a reason that that has been removed. So I don't know that it's something that will come back on unless there's a strong voice for it, maybe from
that. Let me add one thing real quickly for the reports for the court and see what your response is. My thought, two thoughts in any report to the court is the report needs to contain information that I would say is evidentiary, not speculation and just ipsy dixit. You know, I'm an expert, I say it because I think it, but I really couldn't tell you why. Now, meet some sort of evidentiary standard, and secondly, that it really is consistently tied back to the law. You know, in Idaho, you have 32.717, you have 719. If that report doesn't tie back to those factors, then you have something that's kind of just floating out there legally. I had one report not too long ago that was labeled a home study. Well, in the law in Idaho today, a home study is for adoption.
Well, okay, but I agree with that.
Okay.
But then, you know, you also got to be practical about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I've implemented up in council is when I get a stipulated divorce between two parents that's property only, I sign it, goes to the clerk, and it's out of there. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they've agreed. They don't have kids. That's fine. Mm-hmm. All right? So if one person wants X property and the other wants the other, I will not touch that. If they've got kids and there's a stipulation, they're being brought into court.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit there with both parents in front of me and I review the decree and I put them under oath and I ask them if they'll agree to abide by this and if there's any other issues. And so when I do that, I'm looking at them and often it's a gut instinct thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we can't ignore those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
If you come into court and, some guy walks in with muddy boots and cut off shirt, and he smells like booze, and he's just treating the mother of the children like she's, a slave or something like that. I'm going to look at that and go, what's going on there, And so I agree with you that reports to the court shouldn't be speculative, okay? On the other hand, if there's something that you can put your finger on that you think is something relevant that we ought to look at, I'm going to look at it.
So what would you like to see? I mean, if they've both confirmed it in the mediation, or if the mediator just suspects something, I mean, what would you like to see?
Well, I mean, obviously.
Do you need a question mark? Or, I mean, because like Mary said, the checkbox is gone on the status report form, so.
If you're in the middle of a mediation and, all of a sudden one of the parties, let's say it's the mother, just starts breaking down, bawling, crying. And then at some point you get some admission that she's been hit, put in there, look, mom broke down. She indicated that father hit her. I suspect domestic violence. Okay. Is there a liability for you? I don't think there is that, mm-hmm. That's just,
you're reporting what you've been told.
Yeah. You're reporting what you've been told. Now, as Dr. Davidson said, if it's just purely speculative, you have to be careful. But I mean, from my standpoint, I don't let people in my county just, get a bunch of pro se paperwork, fill it out, put a parenting plan in place, and then just hand it over to me for signature, because I have no idea what's going on. So I bring them in, I ask them questions, and I evaluate. Now, most of the time, it's okay. all right? But there are times when I want to know. I wish I could say, here's a rule, here's what you got to do, but life isn't like that. Life is constantly in flux. So I completely subscribe to what you're saying, but on the other hand, I'm one that's going to look at situations and go outside the box. Like Tori said before, I don't pigeonhole myself. I try to look at everything.
Probably one last question before we...
If she in mediation is going to start saying what's going on in mediation, yeah, I'm going to subpoena her. Because then she is a witness, and that's outside the rules. The rules are very, very specific about trying to let people open up in mediation without the fear of them reporting to the judge.
Yeah, that's not admissible. What happens in mediation is not admissible. You can't directly talk to a judge. From a mediator to a judge, that's the worst. Because then you can't cross-examine. Yeah,
Well, so that's probably why that box got taken out of there.
Mediators have to just say they showed up or they didn't show up or whatever. I'm not using a mediator.
There is one kind of aspect that I think might be something that ought to be discussed amongst the judges and maybe with the bar, and that is when someone comes in and does something aggressive to the other in the mediation that may be violent. That I think is probably a little different. That's something. But there's varying levels of that. But this other stuff, I'm really on that same page, because if you have a situation where mom comes in at a certain point, she breaks down, and then she makes a statement about domestic violence, then what you've got is the potential for the mediator to be used to make an accusation through the mediator to the court that has some real potential problems.
So let's do this, just so you know. There's some materials from Family Court Services as well as myself over there. Some of you may need to leave, and we have a question.
And also, on that note, too, if you want any of the materials, I think some of the research that Dr. Davidson referenced, as well as his PowerPoint, make sure your email is on here. I might have it from when you emailed me, but this will probably get scanned and sent to him.
Can you get a question?
I was going to comment on the status report.
Okay.
Well, but I had a question about Fabricius.
Mm-hmm.
So in that qualitative study,
mm-hmm.
was that only college students that were interviewed?
I believe it was. And that's going to be another self-selected issue.
Right.
But part of the problem offsetting things like that is historically the research has always been with moms, you know, as far as quality.
We weren't interviewing kids who first.
So,
right.
The kids who were attending.
Right, exactly. Yeah, this is where the research just can't be slapped down.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've read that one.
Yeah, I...